This is The Channel, a podcast from the International Institute for Asian Studies. Welcome to The Channel. This month, we're bringing you a full episode from our friends over at the Chicken Neck podcast. TCN is Northeast India's first policy-based podcast, offering an informed take on culture, language, food, clothes, history, politics, law, policy, and much more. The episode we're playing today features an interview with Aditya Kiran Kakati, who was formerly a research fellow here at the International Institute for Asian Studies. Aditya's primary research project concerns the global history of Indo-Burman borderlands during and after World War II. But as you'll hear in the interview, Aditya has wide-ranging interests, including a personal as well as academic engagement with food and culinary cultures. In this crossover episode, Aditya discusses the diverse cuisines of Northeast India, as well as the heritage, politics, and taboos that such food brings to the fore. If you like this episode, subscribe to the Chicken Neck podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Because our usual outro won't be attached to the end of this episode, I just want to remind listeners that we at the International Institute for Asian Studies have plenty of ways to connect and get involved. For more information on our conferences, webinars, publications, and fellowship program, please visit IAS.Asia. That's IIAS.ASIA. The channel will be back soon with more episodes of our own, and we have some exciting stuff in the pipeline. But for now, I'm happy to turn over our feed to the Chicken Neck podcast for a conversation with Aditya Kiran Kakati.
Hello and welcome to the Chicken Neck podcast. Supported by the Idea Brews Network, we are a bunch of curious individuals based out of the Northeast, and we strive to bring you the best of policy discussions through the intersection of things that affect your and our daily lives. If you like what we do, show your support by sharing our work. Don't forget to leave your comments on this episode in our social media handles. Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of the Chicken Neck podcast. In our new episode, we have with us Dr. Aditya Kiran Kakati. Aditya is a doctorate in international history with minor in anthropology and sociology from Graduate Institute of Geneva. His PhD thesis was titled Living on the Edge, How Encounters with Global War Remade the India-Burma Frontiers into Polar Wars. Now, I know that PhD thesis itself has so much to break down upon, but fortunately or unfortunately for our listeners today, we are not going to talk about Aditya's PhD, which I think we'll reserve it for another day. What we are going to talk about today is another aspect of Aditya's research, where he primarily looks into, different food habits, or which we would also call how our food habits are basically shaped by where we live, our identities, our history, and everything in between, right? And we were initially, as a podcast, very intrigued by the research that he's doing and the writing that he is doing in this part as to how all of these factors shape into our culinary skills, right? And which you would, of course, delve into in a more specific research-oriented manner. But on that note, Aditya, thank you so much for joining our podcast and welcome to this episode. So before, I get on to asking you to speak further, could you tell us a bit about how you started your journey in researching towards this aspect?
Thank you for having me on this podcast, by the way, which is a great initiative. I think you've been doing some good work and I've listened to some of the episodes. So it's a privilege to be here and having this conversation with you. In response to your question about my own trajectory in this area of research, I began my research during my MA dissertation in Geneva as well. And I began as an ethnohistorian of food influenced by anthropological approaches and did research on emerging urban restaurant cultures in the early to 2010s. The project looked at the emergence of this concept or idea of an ethnic cuisine in India, which was mainly presented as tribal cuisine in practice. In turn, this new phenomena ended up making the tribal cuisine or cuisines from Northeast India, they're not interchangeable, but in the way it was presented, and making it made these cuisines more mainstream and broke caste taboos and tastes by including unfamiliar ingredients and broadening the spectrum of publicly consumed meats. By this time, big Indian cities like Delhi and emerging metropolises like Guwahati began to witness the proliferation of Northeastern restaurants due to the waves of migrations following ceasefires like the Naga NSC and IM ceasefire with India in 1997, but also other ceasefires with various groups in the 2000s. So in this period, in cities like Guwahati too, the notion of tribal food, which was looked down upon due to consuming pork, became more publicly acceptable and in demand. I found that part of this trend in Guwahati, at least, was influenced by the widespread popularity of foods like momos. Momos, for instance, which initially came largely with Tibetan and Nepalese migrants, became a vehicle for transforming taste and breaking dietary taboos among the caste Hindu youth, who could not eat this meat at home otherwise. I think the popularity of Naga food, for instance, which offered unique pork dishes, filled this demand for new tastes. Nagas were the most prominent entrepreneurs in this regard, arguably owing to the transformations in access to capital and mobility created by the ceasefire political economy. My own motivation for this research came from a personal interest in food, which I still cultivate through nascent aspirations as a home chef. Intellectually, I wanted to approach the contemporary history and politics of the region by departing from the predominant paradigm of conflict, by looking for other possibilities. It is another matter that I eventually returned to studying conflict, but through a different historical perspective, by completing my PhD research on the Second World War that occurred here. Part of the food research also drew on my own experiences as a restaurant reviewer for a lifestyle magazine, which I did as a summer job during my undergraduate days. I drew upon emerging literature by scholars like Dolly Kikon, who was working on food at that point of time, and Duncan McDuira, for example, who wrote on racism, and many others. And I continue to write about these issues related to food, identity, and ethnicity alongside my work on conflict and development.
So it's an interesting match of how you try to, you know, delve into your different passions and then make a, you know, a research out of it. So, I mean, of course, we are quite aware of what Professor Dolly Kikon also writes on food and her interesting, very interesting takes on it, in fact. But, you know, I can understand your journey as to how you try to merge your interest for food and cooking and then also your research. I mean, I think kind of highlights that because you're looking at conflict and all of the related areas to then talk about all of that and then merge as well. So when we talk of food, right, for a general person like me, I see your food as very simple, as something that kills my hunger, right? So from that to looking at food first maybe as an art, which is the art of cooking, and then looking at food that shapes our identity. How do you find food to be influential in the way it is, what it is presented before us, and how does it intersect with all of these different elements of our history, of our identity, of violence, of ultra-nationalism, some, and of purity, right? Because you say that these are part of things that you have looked into. So how does food have anything to do with all of this? Could you tell us a little bit about that?
So food, although is very personal, and I think because it is personal, you know, it has various meanings for every individual, has a different meaning for what it, as you said, like, you know, for you, it can be something that you just need to have to stay alive. And from there, it can be like an intense passion for somebody who's a chef or everything in between, right? But also, because of its personal nature and its attachment to identity, right? Because people have very strong ideas. You grow up eating certain kinds of food that becomes part of your the identity that you carry, right? And in the context of places which are different in their history, or have had a difference or divergent notions of history as well, in both in terms of actual ingredients used in that cuisine, but also how the cuisine is imagined, right? Within that. So what happens is that food allows or becomes an arena for contesting different identities. And it becomes a place where different kinds of frictions can emerge. So food inherently is actually political, because it is also personal. And this politics happens at different levels, right? So it is at an individual level. One can get discriminated against for eating certain kinds of food. One can be made fun of. There can be stereotypes, for instance. And on the other hand, this becomes a group phenomena as well sometimes, right? So these kind of stereotypes and prejudices and so on, or bases of discrimination, can also extend to communities as a whole as well. So in that way, food, as you've described it, is something personal, something artistic, something attached to identity. It carries all of those things, and it becomes an interesting arena to study different kinds of social relations.
Okay, so I think that opens up a lot of boxes, right? Because you just, I think through that very short answer itself, now start arguing that food is, even though personal, is also political, right? So on that as well, just to expand upon that, are there elements of, let's say, prejudiced treatment that come out of ignorance of how the eclectic food practices are in a particular region versus food practices in another region of a country or of a continent? I think if we stick to a country, for instance, the food habits in Northeast would be very different from, let's say, the food habits in northern part of the country, or let's say the central part of the country, right? Traditionally, we are also looked at, I mean, people from Northeast consume a lot of meat, for instance, right, of different varieties, which might not be the same in the central part of India or northern part of India. So then, let's say the question of, again, purity and civic order and privileges related to that again comes in. So when I put into all of these elements the idea of food, how do you think one would understand this, added to the point that could this also lead to the idea of discrimination or racism to a certain extent? Just, you know, to understand this better, could you tell us as to how this, all of these factors work in?
Food is an important optic, as you point out, towards understanding racism and discrimination in countries like India, but also beyond, right? Food has been historically an arena in India, at least, for practicing caste and other forms of discrimination, as you rightly pointed out. Notions of purity and pollution emanating from caste-based thinking informed the practices of discrimination and taboo in India. People peripheral within the caste order, like tribal populations in particular, have been subject to such prejudice and discrimination across the country. However, in recent decades, the greater and distinct racialization of such discriminative practices has emerged, which was partly enabled by the fact that people from Northeast India and the Himalayan region have distinct physical features. In experiencing discrimination in places like Delhi, often populations from both regions were treated homogeneously. And in recent years, intellectual discussions and popular culture have tried to bring attention to this issue. For instance, the film Akhuni tried to present this problem, although quite problematically, as critics have pointed out. The film used Akhuni, a term many Nagas use popularly to describe fermented soya beans, as a focal point to enter the issue of racism faced by many Northeasterners due to the smelly nature of this ingredient. The racial notion of smelly foods is not unique to India, and scholars have studied similar issues in other contexts, such as ethnic minorities in Euro-American countries, and more globally in general. Moreover, in 2020, we saw that the COVID-19 pandemic sparked anti-Asian racism worldwide, which used eating preferences as its basis. So today in Guwahati, you'll find that pork is publicly considered an integral part of what is Assamese cuisine, in a way that was not possible even a generation or two earlier. Here, arguably, there is a broadening of the notion of Assamese society that disrupts the caste order, even if it is in a limited manner. But there is still relative unfamiliarity with ingredients like Akhuni, which requires an acquired taste. In the public domain, you now witness greater visibility of Akhuni, For instance, even in national platforms like MasterChef India, which may demystify such food items. Another point that I could add here is in that since the 2010s, and it's a trend that continues today, something called tribal food festivals emerged in the urban context, where a certain kind of rural and rustic cuisine, particularly of minorities like the plains tribes of Assam and Adivasis, featured alongside serving rice beer or apong, which is one of the terms used for it, but there are many others, in a public space, which again was something that was not common or again was seen through prejudice. But here you had this mainstreaming in a very kind of mediated festival space where partly it's been showcased, partly exoticized, but at the same time also made part of the mainstream eating culture.
Again, that's a interesting point you bring out, right? How there has been a practice, you know, there has been now a practice of all of this food being accepted in the larger context as well. You of course talk about MasterChef as platforms which may be demystified the idea, the fact that such food can also be presentable, can be edible for a lot of sections which do not know necessarily about it. But on that context as well, you gave the example of pork, for instance, the fact that it's now much more widely possible to be, it's widely seen to be eaten, at least in the vicinity of Assam. What do you think leads to this change? Is it greater acceptability of such a food item, or a greater acceptability of a cuisine from another state, or is it driven by the fact that more and more people just simply like it and start consuming it? So what factors are playing there?
With regard to pork in particular, in fact, one of the first publications I had was on the matter of pork, and this article or this book chapter was called For the Love of Pork, where I tried to map this phenomena as to understanding how pork became recognized as a mainstream sort of Assamese delicacy. It has existed for a long time among tribal populations, even Hindu tribals, right? Because the normal assumption is that caste Hindu people do not eat certain meats, for example, pork. Whereas there was a time when this began to change in a very public manner. And I tried to track this change in taste that occurred by looking at how momos became a way through which people began to start eating pork. Because, of course, pork was not cooked at home. So the only other way you could eat it was to go outside, perhaps a Chinese restaurant. That was the only kind of space where you could actually find pork or small eateries serving different kinds of tribal cuisine. But it was never in a fine dining context, except in Chinese restaurants. So momos were interesting because this was a street food which was available widely, and started using pork, which is used in momos, right? Like across the Himalayan region, but also in places like Shillong, pork eating was very common. So people who grew up there or had ties to places like in Shillong and so on used to eat pork. But for a larger mass of the population, I think momos became a way, one of the ways, of course, not the only one, through which a new kind of taste developed that, oh, look, there is a new, you know, it's also cool to eat pork, right? Because you are doing some kind of transgression, especially as a young person in a relatively rebellious phase of life. I think it becomes very transgressive, right? To be able to eat something that you're not normally allowed to eat, but you can do it with your friends as you come out of your tuition classes when you go to the momo stall and eat momos. And I think that contributed to a great extent to this cultivating this taste. What took it another step further is the fact that you had ethnic restaurants or restaurants that sold, let's say, Naga food and a few others as well, started to serve this also in a more widely available way. And so availability and the practice of eating was there, but just that what transformed was the demand, first of all, and then also the availability of spaces where you could actually access this sort of meat.
So I think along with acceptance, it is also the presentability of something, and also the fact that, you know, it is more easily available, right? So, and the fact that acceptability comes from availability of something. Like, for instance, when you talk about momos and students, I think it also reminded me of how I think when I was in college, you know, the idea of having momos after classes actually was the goal for going to most of the tuitions and everything, because that was the most cheapest thing to eat right after college. And, you know, all of this thalas that used to have momos. So I was trying to understand how different factors play a role in making a cuisine more attractive to a certain community that has, let's say, not really had that. So I think all of these factors will play in a significant role in making it more attractive.
I just want to add something to the question of acceptability, right? What is interesting is that some years ago, I saw a post by a person on Facebook, an Assamese person, who wrote, he was sort of complaining about the fact that paneer has started intruding into the Assamese kitchen. And he said that, you know, for us Assamese, it's things like pork that are foundational parts of our cuisine, and paneer is kind of encroaching into that, right? Which is the opposite of the usual sort of pro-vegetarian hierarchy that you hear. And I think in Assam, obviously, that has specific historical sort of connotations and so on. But I found it very interesting that somebody would say that, given that I think 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I don't think anybody would have said the same thing in the same manner, right? In terms of pork being so mainstream to Assamese cuisine. It's something that if you go to a very traditional Assamese restaurant in the city, they were not serving pork in their thali. And when I spoke to the owners of this restaurant, for instance, they belong to an upper caste Brahmin background. And I remember explicitly being told that we will not serve pork here, no matter what, right? It doesn't mean that we don't recognize that pork is eaten, but there's a certain concept of a hierarchy, a higher cuisine, if you like, which they claim to preserve, as opposed to what others are doing, what falls in the realm of ethnic cuisine. And I think over time, this sort of hard boundary is probably collapsing because of the demand, because of acceptance and general sort of developed taste for things like pork.
I think, I mean, again, because you say that, and it also comes from a very personal experience as well, that I've seen that a lot of what we consume is also, and I think this is something that you touched upon as well, the caste element of it, right? Because I've seen people coming from a particular community who might, let's say, have pork or chicken or any of this non-vegetarian food outside, but not at home because they do not cook it at home. So that is also another element of the fact that they might be acceptable to it, but not so much at home because, like you said, that they might, like the upper caste Brahmin example that you said, that they might not be willing to cook it at their place, right? So that is also, I think, another fact of that comes in with food and I think politics. But while we are at it, I also wanted to touch upon this entire element of dog meat and Nagaland, right? I mean, because I stay currently in the northern part of of the country, it's actually intriguing. If I say dog meat, there would be so many different opinions, because dog is looked at such an animal that you pet at home. So to have just the idea that the people who are consuming dog meat can be so controversial, right? But the Nagaland government recently, I'm sure you're aware, has decided to ban the commercial import and trading of dogs, right? Prohibiting dog market, which otherwise is a huge market in Nagaland. And what I'm more interested in understanding is the fact that this entire attempt by the government has actually now created a us versus them debate, where there are either very radical groups who support the ban, or there are very radical groups who are like, you know, why is this happening? This is our cuisine, right? So on a situation like this, it also becomes very interesting for us to understand how the food habits which has existed, let's say, for at least a period of time, which of course you could expand on to say how long all of these habits have existed in Nagaland. But what are the cultural and social impacts of something? Because I look at it more like a restriction from the government on something that they have been consuming, right? So how do you see it from a social and cultural aspect, this entire ban that the government is trying to bring in with dog meat?
So before coming to the specifics of this particular case in Nagaland, and that is the article that we wrote in response to this particular phenomena that happened, and the meaning the dog meat ban and the way in which people have responded to it. But before getting into that more specifically, I also want to point out that dog meat in general, globally, has been a very interesting way to understand this sort of food politics, right? Because dog meat in particular, because of, as you said, it has very different sort of personal emotional connections to notions of who's a pet, who's a family member. But also there's a longer history of racial hierarchy which dog meat involves, because across Asian countries where dog meat, like in China, in South Korea and other parts of Korea and East Asia in general, there has been a history of racial, even at a national sort of level, right? So sort of, for example, when Chinese Olympics happened in China, so the dog meat is potent for contestation because of racial hierarchies that have come with it historically, right? So when it comes to especially Asian countries and East Asian countries where dog meat is consumed, this is different when you compare with, for example, Nordic countries' consumption of whale, right? Because there are different rights issues or different kinds of environmental sort of animal rights issues at play there, but it is not racialized in the same way that dog meat consumption is. And there was an example of this that happened at a very kind of international level, where during the 2008 Olympics in China, there was a lot of discourse about dog meat eating. And actually, Chinese government had sanctioned, as somebody has written, a scholar has written, sort of trying to hide that aspect because, you know, global image against sort of consumption of dog meat is not very sympathetic. So I think that in that back, there's a backdrop of racialization that dog meat carries. And as I mentioned earlier with COVID, the consumption of certain animals in general, the idea that certain cultures and certain people eat those animals and that is linked to the causing of this pandemic, again became a way to talk about racial stereotyping, and people face this sort of racial sort of attacks across the world. So now coming back to the specifics of the Naga dog meat controversy, when this ban happened in July 2020. At the outset, I would like to say that this particular article was actually co-authored initially, and this was meant to respond to debates sparked by the dog meat ban in July 2020. This controversy became an entry point to discuss broader issues of how, historically, culture has been mobilized by minority communities to negotiate and express agency. Moreover, states and legal systems worldwide have tried to systematize culture as something that is complete, whole, and unchanging. The intellectual traditions within anthropology and history have challenged such understandings globally by showing that culture is something that is always malleable and changes over time. This you could see in the example of pork eating I mentioned earlier. Culture can be used instrumentally by groups to advocate for rights as well. By exalting culture in a way that makes its legitimacy unquestionable, contributes to fueling this sort of us versus them narrative, as it happened in the case of the dog meat ban. Several public commentators and intellectuals saw the ban as an attack on Naga cultural rights, which is not unfounded given the history of difficulties faced by Nagas. Our response was prompted by the fact that most commentators, including academics, did not really question the use of cultural arguments in this debate. And we tried to understand why cultural rights were attractive. And then we tried to demystify this. And we tried to demystify it by showing its uses in the past to negotiate rights and privileges. So it is not so much about the correctness of the ban itself, The dog meat ban was also an opportunity to closely examine this us versus them narrative in a longer historical context. We find that by decentering culture in these narratives, they can be challenged in a way that creates opportunities to view rights issues through other frameworks. This research also took us towards new and exciting dimensions of thinking about food and relationships with non-humans, including as new forms of resistance. For instance, we found examples of how specific Naga communities started killing Amur falcons at one point in time, and this was done to get attention from the international wildlife conservation community towards a local political dispute created by the diversion of funds from that particular constituency. Moreover, we compared dog meat consumption to rampant illegal hunting and eating of endangered animals, which comes with its own set of problems. When such instances are defended using cultural rights arguments, but in situations that are far removed from the cultural context of former hunter-gatherer societies today, there's a need to pay closer attention to the monolithic us versus them logic, because this logic distracts from the nuances and actual stakes at play. By exposing culture's malleability and how it has been used to both claim and deny rights, shows its unreliability as a basis for making productive arguments that could challenge us versus them type of binary narratives. One of the co-authors adds to this point by reminding us that the traditional way of eating dogs in Nagaland involved keeping dogs for hunting or even as pets and eating them when required for protein or for medicinal purposes. But this was mostly done in a humane way. The real objection to the commercial dog meat trade in Nagaland, which is a relatively recent development, was its scale and cruelty. Moreover, the fact that dog meat was and is still eaten by many in Nagaland should not become the basis for stereotyping either, which using cultural arguments can only exacerbate. Unfortunately, my co-authors and other collaborators also chose to remain anonymous in the writing of this article, which is telling of the sensitive nature of discussions around food and rights, particularly within Naga society. The entry point of food, which looks very banal, emerges to have high stakes socially and politically.
It also shows, in a way, the political argument, again, coming back to how the personal food habits also form a political identity, reflecting on the fact as to how, you know, how particular the Naga society is with regards to their own food practices, as you just mentioned. It also, you know, I was just checking that I think at least for the Naga ban now, Guwahati High Court has kind of squashed that that ban. But having said that, this is more relevant also to the context that Shubham had pointed out, that it is also Mizoram who wanted to bring such an amendment to their state act as well. They wanted to amend and, you know, they bring an amendment, they could have legalized this ban in Mizoram as well. So I think primarily, at least for a lot of the northeastern states, this idea of what you consume and, you know, and how that reflects on the society is a larger concern. And I think it has, I mean, jurisprudentially, you could argue it's the same thing as what is happening with the example of whale that you gave. Because again, I think, and now I think I would like to come to that jurisprudential element as well, because when I think of food from a legal or a jurisprudential angle, it has evolved over time, right? And for instance, the example of, let's say, China that you gave, or the whale example that you gave, this has been food practices that have existed in a particular society, which of course with time has evolved, which could also probably include the idea of whether I would have, the dog example, for instance, you used the term protein. So maybe the Naga society looked at it as a source of protein at a point of time, which has evolved. Now we see dogs as more of domestic pets. So that idea of loving a dog might not have probably existed, let's say, some few decades or years back, so or hundreds of years back. So that in a larger context, is it also then a conflict between the freedom to eat and restriction on what not to eat? And I ask this from a perspective where even if the state, right, the state or the center, if it has a right to ban what we eat, is now the idea of what is political or what can be regulated also coming within our homes, right? Which, I mean, it can happen when I, let's say, if that right is with respect to me voting, because I have the freedom of whether I would like to vote or not. But here, what is interesting is when we talk of fundamental rights and all of these issues, we say that our right should not impact somebody else, right? Now, if I am, let's say, cooking something that's smelling bad, for instance, even if I take it to that aspect, my neighbor might be impacted because I have a bad smell in the thing that I'm eating. But if something that I'm not eating does not have a bad smell, I do not bother my neighbor, then it is my right to eat what I want to, unless it's another human being, because the rights are for human beings. So on that context, when you look at it larger, in a larger picture, the regulation of what I eat versus who tells me what to eat, is this a problem which impacts what I am as an identity, an individual, and the culture that I come from? If my culture allows me to eat dog meat, if I'm consuming it in Delhi, let's say, which does not the society is not accepting of it, then is it a conflict of different bundle of rights and obligations that the society versus individual has? So how do you look at that particular issue?
Right. So this is actually a question that you guys as lawyers are better placed to answer and engage perhaps. But it is also interesting to have this conversation with you, right, for the same reason. Now, let me try to think of it from the point of view that minorities like Nagas enjoy constitutional protections, right, through the Article 371A, for example, when it comes to practices and beliefs in general. However, meat consumption is also a larger public concern in relation to health and environmental concerns. Our co-author suggested that consumption of food, any food, should be only restricted by the state if they pose a health risk, reflect an illegal trade, or involve cruelty to animals, which in addition to, as you said, should not also impact the rights of another individual, right? And we can come back to this probably because it is slightly difficult when it comes to, you know, who gets offended and so on, that kind of thing. But aside from that, there are health risks, illegal trade involved, and cruelty, which are more tangible, let's say, factors that can help determine how to approach the question of restrictions on food. I would also add that protecting the right to eat certain foods in an unregulated manner can be dangerous. So, for example, if you give particular rights to indigenous, so-called indigenous communities, right? So protect their religious and ritual beliefs. So that could be an argument, and that was an argument actually made by some lawyers in response to this ban, that strategically, if Nagas want to consume that consume dog meat without any sort of restriction, one way is to kind of argue for this meat to be classified as something that can be an exception in indigenous ritual context. But doing so will open up new kinds of problems for defining who is actually an indigenous community, which is already a very difficult sort of set of debates within Assam and Northeast and India as a whole. But I think in Northeast, it has very specific connotations. And then also alongside that, what foods should qualify as legitimate recipients of legal protection within this kind of an indigenous discourse, right? But all of this will not shift the discourse towards the real issues actually at hand. Moreover, the practical experiences and the intellectual critiques of doctrines like multiculturalism, when you talk about rights in places like Canada, these sort of rights were meant to address minority concerns and have shown that group rights on the basis of culture is problematic. I'm talking about multiculturalism, which is a set of principles, especially in Canada. For one, using culture as a static and homogeneous set of practices for the basis of rights actually reproduces essentialism, which can be loosely defined as the tendency to see groups and individuals carrying a set of properties, in quotes, and attributes which are assumed to be central to their identity. While in reality, human beings are more complicated and carry multiple of often seemingly contradictory tendencies, right? So when you talked about this shift from protein to pets, actually in many cultures, or I won't say cultures, sorry, that's not the right word, but I think in many contexts where people are farming and have livestock, I think there, you know, there's a growing set of literature as well that that looks at this relationship of intimacy between different different communities and the animals that they keep. But that does not necessarily, just because there's love and intimacy, does not mean that they can't sell those animals to a slaughterhouse and also consume them themselves, right? So this is fairly common in sort of rural context, probably across the world. So individual democratic human rights could possibly be an alternative framework for such concerns, because the individual can hold the freedom to eat what they want freely as long as it is legal and safe. And if I may add what you said, it's not also directly affecting anyone in that sense. But one community should not have the right to deny another on the basis of cultural claims, nor should another community have to resist such impositions based on cultural rights. In such cases, as we can see, there's a tendency to create greater differences and divisions within society. And this is antithetical to the harmonious coexistence of people with various different backgrounds.
Yeah, I think you kind of answered a question that I had with respect to, because I asked about the bundle of rights and conflict between different rights. I think I also had a question as to whether this entire, ban with the Nagaland ban that we had discussed, how the element of, the food that we eat and its impact on diseases, the zoonotic diseases, how does that come in? Because ultimately that would also be, I think, an argument that one side would, have when they advocate for such a ban or otherwise, right? And the potential health risks of consuming such meat as we delve into a different era where our bodies have also evolved, which I think a lot of times we keep forgetting. But I think on a legal standpoint as well, the idea of whether such legal protection should work for them and at all should this legal protection or any kind of exception should be made for a particular community before that come, because so of late, so much of the food that we have or the food that we eat has been in so much conversation in from politically as well, right? So I think there are different arguments. The paneer example that you gave as well, I myself have seen my own personal experience dictate that paneer is something that that is more, let's say, widely eaten at places where you have more availability of milk, which is not necessarily the case in Northeast. I mean, now it is because of a more globalized world, but it is not as maybe as much available in quantity as it is in northern part of the country, let's say. And ultimately, it's the body that we need to, help with the maximum number of different fibers and proteins. So I think that as well. And it's interesting to understand how all of this comes into politics, because I know that from a legal standpoint, I think as students of law, we are better placed. But it also, I wanted to also understand the sociological impact or the cultural impact of what the intersection of different rights should have, which I think you kind of pointed out. But on a note to end all of this conversation in a way, what I want to understand throughout your research, let's say when you wrote on the Nagaland ban or all of this, the Mizoram ban that I just spoke about, how crucial is food, right? In forming an identity of an individual, and how does this greater idea of people dictating today of what we eat, how does it impact the identity that we form? Because just to again lay it more simply, what I would like to understand is, because I have a particular food habit, right? Because I come from a particular community. Now, because somebody's telling me what I should eat or should not eat, does it impact my greater identity as an individual from that particular community? If I'm asked to eat or not eat something, how does this relationship work?
I think in a democratic country, there should, one community cannot have a right to tell another community what to eat or not to eat, right? You could have legal restrictions, as we discussed earlier, based on other factors, which could be on health and which could be on safety and better regulation in general, right? Especially when it comes to consuming things like meat, which has the potential for contamination of various kinds. and can bear diseases as well. Aside from that, I think food and identity is a very personal and very sensitive issue, right? So when somebody says that you cannot eat something, it means that you may want to eat that still, but you'll have to do it in hiding, right? Now, if constitutionally and legally you have the right to eat that food as an individual, not necessarily as a community, how is that compatible, right? And I think that here you can see the difference between what we think of as smelly food. And I think Dolly Kikon has talked about this in one of her articles when she's talking about Akhuni, is that what somebody else may call smelly could be fragrant for somebody else as well, right? And I think that then changes the foundation on which we can then imagine what kind of bundle of rights are we talking about, right? Is it an individual right? Is it a community right? I think for most part, if you are not encroaching directly upon somebody else's rights, it should be fine, right? And I think that because identity is something that you will carry with food, and it's not only identity, it's also your taste, it's your habits, everything is involved in that. So in principle, I think that it is not compatible if especially a community takes a stand on telling another community what to eat or not to eat.
Yeah, I think that's a very good note to end on, and especially the idea of how smell for someone can be fragrance for somebody else. It just makes me think more on all of these issues, I think. And I think just to end on this from my perspective as well, I think, the ban on something, like you said, I mean, for instance, the fact that one example could be alcohol ban, right? Just because certain states have banned alcohol, it doesn't mean that you do not actually find alcohol. It's just that it's done in black. I think if there's a community which eats a particular type of food, which we end up banning, which it would mean that there is access to it, but not in the regular way, but in a more, in a black market, which means that there would be not enough hygienic, availability of that food. Not hygiene wouldn't be, taken care of, which in turn would lead to more disease, because if people still continue to do it. So I think from that point, I think it's better to regulate this through specific markets, through specific places which provide with such food, and so that they take care of the hygiene as well. For that, of course, we have to appreciate the kind of food that everybody or the other community eats. So yeah, I think that's at least my views on it. But it is, Aditya, a great honor to have you. I think this is a conversation we have wanted to have for a very long time, to talk about food and its impact on all of these different facets in our life, including politics. And I know there's been a lot of to and fro for us to get the dates done, but I'm so glad that this happened. And on that note, thank you so much for coming to the Chicken Neck Podcast. It's been an absolute privilege speaking to you about such an interesting aspect. I'm sure we'll need more episodes to get into your PhD as well at some point.
Thank you so much. The privilege and honor has been mine, because it has allowed me to engage with you, especially as lawyers, to sort of think about questions that I actually don't have that much expertise on when it comes to question of rights and legality and jurisprudence when it comes to thinking about food. But I also want to take this opportunity to quickly say, because you referred to my PhD and other research, I think broadly my research stems from trying to understand various aspects of globalization. So when it can be food, it can be conflict, it can be war. They're all linked by this thread of globalization, I think, and different time periods of different waves of globalization as well. And here I have to say that my so-called shift from studying food, of course, I continue to engage with food-related writing and also in other forms, but what I realized as I was moving between food and conflict is that philosophically, the question that interested me is still the same or similar. They find convergence in the fact that I'm interested in understanding how do we understand histories of certain people and certain places only in specific ways. So it turns out that when we look at Northeast India, whether it's the issue of food or about conflict, there's a specific way of caricaturing and imagining people there. And I think these sorts of relationships are, of course, ever-changing, right? There are now mainstreaming, as we saw. But on the other hand, the question of representation, and then with that, of course, comes things like rights as well, is something that I realized that without realizing, I was in a way pursuing as part of that research. So I think, yes, I'll be happy to have a conversation about conflict and war and the Second World War in particular, which had a very strong foundation in actually creating Northeast as we know it today.
Yeah, I think I get what, you know, how all of this, you say, are factors that have played in a great role in shaping who we are today, including, you know, our food habits. So I'd be glad to have that conversation and to include, maybe speak more on food and also conflict and your PhD. We do a longer episode at some point of time. But thank you so much, Aditya. It's been an honor, like I said. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode of the Chicken Neck Podcast, check out our other episodes available across all major streaming platforms and help us grow by spreading the word. And for more updates, do follow us on our social media handles.